All right, welcome back to another episode of the Real Ballers Read podcast. I have a very, very special guest with us today, my friend, my brother, Zach Kirk. He is a man of many titles, but he is the love of history, working class people, and Bay Area rap music personified. It's my friend, Zach Kirk. Zach, can you give us a little intro?
No, I want to thank Miles, and Miles made some allusions there, but Miles and I are fraternity brothers and went to school together. So that's how we got to know each other.
And we're brothers, by the way.
All brothers, yes. But I was born in Bay Area and was raised here. I'm Polynesian. Miles and I went to Stanford together, and I did a little bit of studying about, you know, Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, Black radical movements, which I kind of take, you know, great inspiration from. And yeah, I do work now around social justice in the criminal legal system in California, specifically focusing on, you know, corrupt police, gang enhancements, and kind of the legal taxes that are felt in kind of years served, you know, in the cell that brown and black people, you know, feel in California, which is kind of a state that a lot of people expect is pretty progressive, but, you know, has built, you know, one kind of college in the last 30 years and has built, I think, about, you know, 20 prisons. So that gives you an idea of what the prerogatives of California is. And so I think it's a really interesting task to, like, look at California past this, what we know it to be, like, this kind of land of liberal promise. So, yeah, I could kind of talk about why that's the book that I selected. It wasn't one of the books like Kwame Ture or Malcolm X or something that I actually love reading, but was something kind of that exposed a little bit about California and how, you know, maybe some, you know, reasons why our movements fall.
Yeah. So you started there to introduce the book a little, but tell us a little bit more about the Glass House Tapes and, like, why you find it interesting.
Yeah. So this is a book that you probably will never find if you're looking in a library. It's not on Amazon. I know Miles and Janet and I probably did a Google search trying to find a physical copy just to see if we could get it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And what's probably, you know, the lowest figure you found, the lowest I found was $120 for this book. And it's something around that, but it's a book that's 50 years old. It was printed, I believe, in 1972, and it's called The Glass House Tapes. And it's not by this guy named Lewis Tackwood, but it's by this committee, which is called the Citizens Research Investigation Committee. And it has a bunch of names in the front of the book. A lot of them, if you don't know kind of California politics, won't matter. One of them is Mae Brussel. People will know her as, like, a major conspiracy theory researcher looking into Jonestown, the MLK assassination, the RFK assassination. And that's Mae Brussel. There's another guy called Donald Freed, who's a kind of a big California mind and researcher, and they kind of came together. Their names are in the front of the book. But how all this story started is they were approached by this kind of black man who they was 28, 29 years old. And he told them something crazy, which is, you know, I've been a snitch for the LAPD and the FBI for the last 10 years. And so immediately they were worried about this because Mark Duggan and Marilyn Katz, they were both part of what, you know, what called the Students for Democratic Society. And they, you know, they got their start doing Vietnam War protests because, you know, they were college students and were the ones being drafted, and they opposed that. And eventually Students for Democratic Society, it took a bit of a split. And there was, you know, the Weathermen faction, which was known for kind of some bombings that happened. That they were involved in and took a, you know, very, very radical position on what you should do after during the Vietnam War, and took, you know, pretty much went up into arms against them. And so Marilyn Katz and Duggan were, you know, part of this faction that believed that the U.S. government was way out of step in what it was doing in Vietnam. And so what they wanted to do, and they believed, you know, that their own the Students for Democratic Society was totally ruined by informers and also by kind of bad tactics and other things, but they wanted to study this idea of informers. So the Citizens Research Committee was doing a book on this, and Tackwood somehow, through one of his sources, heard that they were doing a book on this and approached them. And they heard what he was saying, and they pretty much said, "Oh no, this guy's lying, and he's still undercover for the LAPD." You know, they were certain he was wearing a wire. So they do all of these kind of series of interviews. One of the really funny things in the book is that like Duggan is they invite Taquin in, like Duggan's upstairs and like interviewing him, and Taquin's downstairs, and he's like trying to conceal it. And Taquin at a point's just like, "Nah, be real with me. I'm leaving if we don't get this done." And they meet face to face, and like finally, you know, the people who had the most fear in meeting Taquin were these leftists. And finally, they talk and they record 8 hours with Taquin, and it becomes incorporated into the Glasshouse tapes. And you get to know a little bit about Taquin through there's some recordings on YouTube and press conferences if anyone's interested. But I mean, this guy's voice is amazing. It sounds like, you know, there's kind of people talk about like the jive talk that the Panthers used to do, and this guy has the total mastery of it. And it's just amazing to hear him talk. There's one thing, I'll edit it and add it to the end, but there's this call that he has with the LAPD officer where he's totally just entrapping him into mentioning some of the stuff that they're having Taquin doing, which is involves buying dynamite on behalf of the LAPD with LAPD money, and he gets this LAPD officer to say it on the phone, and so you really hear how smart this guy is. But I'll give a bit of a biography of who exactly this Taquin guy is and why, you know, he is like this, you know, Forrest Gump of Black radical politics. He's everywhere, and I'll tell you some of the places he is. But he's everywhere, and he pops up just with in places that you would, you know, believe is unbelievable, and really makes us, you know, reconsider what was happening in the 60s and how much of this was really predetermined or in some way determined by forces and people like Taquin who were getting paid only hundreds of dollars to really do some really bending history in the wrong direction. But as you know, Taquin's born in the early 40s, and his father is a drug dealer, and he's killed when he's really young. He has links to New Orleans and comes to LA, and his father, his earliest memories, I think 4 or 5, is his father getting killed in a drug deal gone bad. By the age of 12 or 14, he's already a leader of the Hun gang, which is one of the like historical street gangs in LA that came apart. And he talks about in the book, in response to getting beat up by groups of white boys who would rove around and come around the neighborhood and beat them up. There are also kind of other ethnic groups that were fighting with them that led to this. But, you know, by the age of 14 or 15, Louis Taquin is having conferences with Black and, you know, Latino youth, cutting up different parts of the city. There's a part in the book where he talks about, you know, we'll get Inglewood, and they, you know, they're arguing over blocks and stuff like this. And it's just amazing to think, you know, this guy's 14 years old at a table with, you know, 20 other guys who are 14 years old, you know, cutting up the city into, you know, because, you know, to be honest, like there are two parts of the city. There's one that the police patrolled, and then there was one that the, you know, of the streets where the people in the working class people had control of the streets. And, you know, he at 14 years old was calling the shots on this. So whether or not we believe Taquin is also a different point, but he comes through on a lot of really, really interesting other knowledge. So I'm going to, you know, at least take him at his word there. He's busted in 62 for stealing cars where they're, he says they're transferring across the Mexican border, you know, and this is where he gets busted. So 1962. And, you know, when they say, well, if you flip, we won't give you any prison time. And this starts of, you know, crazy 10 years for Taquin, where he, you know, he's setting people up. He's going to drug deals and he's, you know, getting arrested with them. And suddenly he pops up on the stand and he'll be the one testifying. You know, he testifies against this one guy, he says, for the car stealing, and then he falsely testifies and implicates him in a murder. And so the guy that he talks about, and he'll say this on these press conferences, is currently on death row at the time that the book is published. I tried to do some research and I couldn't find out if he got off death row, but kind of my knowledge of the California justice system might say that he was still on it. Wow. And then, you know, there's also kind of drug deals that he's involved in 63. So he's actively selling drugs, he says, for the LAPD to try to get a handle on what's happening. In 65 is, you know, Malcolm X gets assassinated in February. And so what 64 is what they called the hot summer. And then 65 was the next hot summer where there were riots in Watts for the first time. There were riots in Harlem as well, I believe. And the LAPD and people above the LAPD, meaning kind of like the FBI's, like the state FBI would be the way to put it. And people who had a direct line to Hoover began to see that there was a need to infiltrate militant groups as well. And so this is in 65. And this is when Tackwood goes from, you know, a car thief and turning on car thieves and drug dealing to infiltrating militant groups. He goes, I'll just do a quick list because it's he goes through the Panthers. He is friends with, you know, Mark Carr. It's almost impossible to say. He is has links with Ron Karenga, who's the person who created Kwanzaa. But, you know, through 65 to 71, and if you know Black radical politics, that's exactly the time where it's going. So I'll give you just a list of events that he had foreknowledge or was involved in. And I can talk about this one especially. One is the 1972 conspiracy to bomb the Republican National Convention in San Diego, which he alleges was from the state trying to blame protesters who would be on the outside at the Republican National Convention in 72 on a bombing that would be placed inside the convention and would be used to seen as like done by leftists. And Nixon would create a state of exception where he could create like a law and order and not have the election. This is what Tackwood, as part of the plan, said what he thought what the plan was. So this is one of them. It doesn't happen, of course, because Tackwood comes out and spills the beans on all of this stuff before it happens. But there are other things that did happen. One of them is that he gave guns to the US organization or the United Slaves Organization, which he gave to Ron Karenga. People might know Ron Karenga because he was the one who came up with the concepts of Kwanzaa, came up with the seven concepts that would later be Kwanzaa. Mm-hmm. But the US organization had a very kind of infamous public beef with the Black Panthers that resulted in John Huggins and Bunchy Carter getting killed in UCLA. So the guns that killed them were given to the US organization by Lewis Tackwood. That's another one of them. In 65, there was a raid on the Black Muslim Mosque in LA. The person who was, I think, either across the street or in the mosque at the time said that there were guns there. The person who made that call was Lewis Tackwood. It resulted in, I think, violence and a bunch of arrests of Black Muslims. He had foreknowledge of the Watergate break-in. He identified E. Howard Hunt and McCord, who were both, two of the burglars who were there, by their code names that they would later be exposed by. He infiltrated the Berkeley mayoral campaign on the leftist side. He, in fact, admitted that he was an informant to them at one point, which is pretty interesting. And they say that he admitted that he was an informant to them. So you'll see at all points is like, well, you know, what is this game that Tackwood's playing? Another one, he infiltrated the New Orleans, mob underground in 6 months. And this is something that he says after doing a murder on behalf of LAPD to keep this cover. And when I say LAPD, it's called the CCS. It's the criminal conspiracies section of, and they're a special section. They're not like really involved with the LAPD, but they sit in their offices are in the LAPD. Thus the Glass House, which is one of those towers downtown where a lot of this, counterintelligence work is undertaken. He claims that there was funding of occult groups by the LAPD as like part of some blackmail scheme. Crazy, right? Another one in terms, and I think the book's not behind me, but he was involved and there was, or he was not involved, but he had foreknowledge of the murder of George Jackson, meaning that the how George Jackson died in the official account is that he did an escape attempt. Mm-hmm. And he was killed during the escape attempt, or there was some fight. It's confusing. But Tackwood says that he was told the day after that Jackson was killed that they had known for months that escape plan was happening, meaning that and if anyone doesn't know, and I know the protocol in California prisons, if someone escapes, you're allowed to shoot them, which is what happened. Is he got shot from the guard towers? And then the last one is he had foreknowledge. Of kind of the plot at the Marin County Courthouse where Jonathan Jackson, there was a big standoff and Jonathan Jackson went inside. And eventually what it ended up in is that Angela Davis was implicated the government said that she was connected to the weapons. And Tackwood, you know, talks about this and said, you know, one of the reasons he came forward was, and this is really interesting, and I think it was on the kind of the good points of Tackwood, is he says, you know, she was a good sister. I couldn't take it anymore. He saw what was happening to Angela Davis, this months-long framing. And remember, Angela Davis isn't some random person on the street. She's a professor. She's a writer and a theorist and a revolutionary at this time. So she is target number one, and according to Tackwood, had been set up. So in terms of, if you had a list of the events of the 60s and 70s of Black radical events, that's about a third of them right there. And Tackwood has a, you know, has a hand in all of them. So it really is, like I said, he's the Forrest Gump of this thing, except, you know, he's not the Forrest Gump. He's being placed there, and he's putting it, plus, you know, he's putting himself in these positions. So that's really all I had on just, you know, the basic points of who Tackwood is and what was his life. And I would just say, you know, he came out with all of this stuff. And, you know, after 75, no one heard from Tackwood again.
Is he still alive? That was what we were confused about.
Like I said, after 75, no one heard from Tackwood again. So there's
Chess Master.
Chess Master. I mean, we can imagine.
Now he's done, but you know.
Yeah, you can imagine they either got, you know, someone got to him, or he's, you know, living on a beach somewhere. You know, so he doesn't talk anymore. I like to think.
Wait, how do you even like find this book? Did somebody just like send it to you in the mail? You know what I'm saying? Like, where did this even come about?
Yeah, it's one of those books where you can't find it online, but if you look in the footnotes of a lot of books, like the base knowledge about Ron Karenga, you know, being connected to U.S. intelligence and you know, being integrated into that comes from Tackwood. The stuff about the conspiracy at the RNC, that comes from Tackwood. The tip about the Black Muslim mosque, that comes from Tackwood. Part of our knowledge of Watergate comes from Tackwood. Like I said, there's this funding of a cult group that's the citation from Tackwood. And so and then the George Jackson, that comes from Tackwood. And then the part about Angela Davis, that comes from Tackwood. So he is like the primary source for, you know, against all of these kind of conventional narratives that we have about these things. So he's like the starting point that people who do research, they have, because in 71, he was telling you, no, you might think, you know, Jonathan Jackson was a hero going into the courthouse. But what Tackwood said is they knew he was going to do it. There were actually seven or eight other guys who were going to do it, but they saw that the courthouse was so well guarded. So he goes in there, and this is what Tackwood said, only because they let him in there. He was in a trench coat. And so Tackwood's whole thing is that it's a conspiracy by the government to let these things happen. And so the answer is that it's all in the footnotes, right? I was kind of reading through this stuff, and I'm like, who is this Tackwood guy who is cited every time we're talking about George Jackson or Angela Davis? And he's saying something that's completely different than what anyone else is saying, who's not a Panther, right? The Panthers will cite Tackwood because they're like, look, this is the guy, this is what we've been talking about the whole time. You know, they're informing on us. All right, you know, this is the reason why our organizations are failing, is because we have people who are, you know, doing violent acts, you know, getting guns and shooting people. And that's not what we wanted to do as an organization. So I think that's part of the reason he's just everywhere. If you read the footnotes of a lot of these books studying the events of the 60s and the 70s.
Mm. Wait, so to backtrack a little bit on the Jonathan Jackson story, like, he was killed in the courthouse, right? Because he tried to open fire. Like, what happened again?
Yeah.
And how would they have prior knowledge of him going in?
The idea, and this is what Tackwood said, is that he was sent up to Santa Cruz. If people realize, or if people remember, that's where a lot of this stuff was happening, was in Santa Cruz, because that was where, you know, that was one of the more radical universities. But Tackwood says that him and his wife were sent up to Santa Cruz because they got information that there was training going on to do some kind of breakout attempt. And so he went up specifically to, you know, to the Bay Area, to Santa Cruz, to sniff this thing out. And he doesn't talk specifically about what he found up there, but he does talk about that was his job. They were driving around Santa Cruz, driving around San Jose, pointing out houses where this training could be happening, because they had heard through other informants that it was happening. So that was his knowledge, you know, reason that he knew about that, is that he was involved in, you know, months and months before, in trying to get information on it, on what exactly was going to happen.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, when I was reading the book, I was just in disbelief how he could survive through all of this. Cause he just clearly had such good police protection. Like, cause even that first initial rat out of his friends. He turned in two of his friends who were convicted for stealing cars. I just don't understand how you can live for the next like 10 years doing the same thing.
He said, I don't have a single friend that I don't inform on. He was like, I inform on all my friends. I was like, do you have friends, G? Like, what is happening? You
know, yeah, it really is like using your relationships, like monetizing your relationships to the max, right? He was selling information to the highest bidder, and usually it was the government. Yeah. But you know, there is, you know, and this is the interesting part. There's something that changes because like he'll even say it, like he calls the Black Panther ideology, this is his quote, humbug. He thinks, you know, I hope I'm not misquoting, but his about the Black Panthers is he thinks they're just kind of out there, you know, doing a lot but not wanting to change anything. Mm-hmm. He has a different view of how these things should work. He doesn't talk about it too much, but he says like, yeah, my politics is I don't think the LA should be, you know, doing all this provocation. LAPD should be doing all this provocation and, you know, let the Black people figure it out, the Latinos figure it out, and, you know, figure it out for themselves. So it's pretty interesting how he comes at it from a way different place than everyone he's around. But, you know, their stories are totally aligned in terms of what they think the government is doing and like what the maximum extent of what the government is willing to do to stop, you know, to stop the revolution.
And I hate about Tackwood that you like somewhat have to admire him. Like we were talking about Bill O'Neill and how he's, you know, just like the worst cautionary tale, like a snitch and like just a low life of like a human, but he's just clearly not as smart as like Tackwood is and just like was a pawn where like he's Tackwood is like trying to be a lion of history. And you can even see in the way he like set up like writing of the book and everything. But like, you know, I still don't know how I feel about him, but like.
Yeah. It's hard not to read that and feel like, wow, this guy's like the slipperiest man alive. And to kind of in your mind, give him that award, even though, you know, like, you know, his damage to the movement's real. Like, you know, the Black Muslims, and it's every part of the movement. It's on not only to the Panthers. Like he was really informing on the Black Muslims too. You know, he was informing on just his friends and stuff like that. So there's real damage to the movement. Like he could have at any point said, yo, like Angela, like, yo, they're going after you. Like, you know, please, like, watch out. Or he could have told Jonathan, like, you know, stop. Like he could have done all these things earlier. But he chose to do it, you know, during kind of the trial of Angela Davis, which is where this is kind of, you know, which is the context of this. Miles, I just wanted to, you know, the best quote, which is the one that's quoted over and over, and this is from Tackwood, and it just gives you a little bit. And it's hard to know if he's just, you know, trying to play himself up in front of the camera, and maybe he's just his best, you know, his own best hype man.
Right.
But this gives a little kind of peek into his mind. And this is a quote, I think, from the LA Times, quote, "I think I'm smarter than any of the officers I've come into contact with. I can survive out there where they can't. I can play the double game. Yet they look down on me. All the time it was tickling to me even to play counterplots on them and counterplots on the other side too. These are people who think they can just conspire against me. And they're playing with the master of conspiracy. They're just feeding my appetite for conspiracy. I finally found somebody who's willing to play the game." Yeah, I mean, Miles and I were talking earlier, just sending back kind of Tackwood quotes of just ridiculous things he was saying. But like one of them is like Miles says like his three favorite authors, right?
And right.
They're Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, and Machiavelli. Like, you know, he just doesn't want to be liked, and he just is like you can totally tell he just has this love for power and chess and like you know, playing like it's a game and like he's not gonna die, and somehow he doesn't, you know, that we know doesn't die, you know, from 62 to 73, 11 years he is out there playing the, you know, the highest high risk chess, you know, playing with the police, the FBI, the Black radical movements, assuming that they're just not going to kill him, you know, common car thieves and people assuming that they're not going to kill him. Like Miles said, like how does he expect, you know, just with by the seat of his pants, just to, you know, to lie, inform on people, and just to be able to, you know, walk around his community and stuff like that. It really is amazing that, you know, he was like at every point, just doing the most risky decision and the most short-term decision that was just going to pay off in a big payoff. Because of course, you know, he gets paid for convictions. He gets paid for testifying. He gets paid for information. So you have to, the reason he's doing all this stuff isn't just because he loves it, but he's also getting a check for all of these things he's doing. And he's, you know, he works his way up the ladder, which I think is the important part is if Tackwood wasn't so effective at all this stuff, we wouldn't have any of this information, right? And because at a certain point, his whatever, if it was his, you know, he wanted to write a book or he felt like, you know, a twinge of morality at some point, like if, you know, it's only because Tackwood was moved, it's his way up the ranks that we even know stuff about, you know, the George Jackson or, you know, what was happening behind the Marin County courthouse plot and all of these things. It's only because he got so high that they trusted him with this stuff. And it really is a good question. Why did he abandon them at the last second when, you know, when he's like, oh, well, you know, I don't like that they're doing all this provocation when he's the main agent of provocation in LA for, you know, during these couple of years. It really is amazing. Just like his love for kind of the strategy of it all and acting like he just, you know, his life doesn't exist and he's not really in any real danger. It's pretty confusing.
So knowing and learning everything that you know about Lewis Tackwood, or like just this time in history, American history in particular, like how has that changed the way that you look at like the current day to day, like politics and just situation, everything, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, it does wonders to your brain, right? Because if like, imagine you learn conventional history where you think, Black Panthers fell, you know, there's some informants, but once you realize that, you know, these major events, which were violent events, you know, were not actually at the will of Black Panthers who had the ideology at heart, but instead people who had like pockets for like violent events and like crimes occurring, then it really does make you reframe like, you know, how much do we need the guns, or like what role does the gun play still, or, you know, how much does what kind of organizing do we need to do? It really makes us question, I think, those types of things. But also, like, if Tackwood is like this undercurrent that's, you know, moving the ship of history, like in crazy ways, just as this one person, like, yeah, it does make us wonder, like, how is, you know, the ship of history being moved now with, you know, not just informers, but, you know, through media, through things like that. Like, this is one guy. And that's the thing that I think is so amazing, that COINTELPRO is a bunch of agents. It's a bunch of assets. I mean, it's hundreds and thousands across cities and cities and cities. And this is one guy with his hand in all of these different things. So I think it's just like, that should be the scary part, is we have to hope that there aren't this many Lewis Tackwoods today. But we also have to hope that, like, these agents who were running him were in certain ways incompetent and they made mistakes. And we have to hope that, you know, the people who are doing that today also are incompetent, are also making mistakes. But, you know, Tackwood is a learning, I think, lesson for, you know, I think people where I sit, where, you know, we have to understand of, you know, you have to trust people in the movement. We have to, building trust and being suspicious of people who come in saying, let's shoot up the place. You know, that is always, you know, as we can see from like the tackle, is always some evidence that there's some fishy stuff going on. Because that's not how these things work, even if you wanted to, you know. And I think that's one of the things, is that, you know, like instances of violence and provocation and protests are things that we always have to look at more closely, especially with the Black Panthers, as we know that like a lot of times, you know, police would shoot at them in like Fred Hampton. You know, they claim that he shot at them first. You look at the bullet casings on the bullet holes on the wall. It's like 100 in, and then there's maybe one bullet hole coming out from him, and then 100 in from the police. So I think that things like that are important. Just to think like, wow, let's just hope there aren't Tackwoods in the world. And I think we have to know that, yeah, there must be Tackwoods in the world. People who can do this stuff, but people who when they reach the top levels of this intelligence, they don't turn and come to the public and be very honest, as I think Tackwood was being, but they, you know, they live out their lives. They get a 401k, they get a pension, and they, you know, they get a beach house and all of these different things. So I think that those are the things that we probably need to be looking for now when it comes to Tackwood, especially. I think there's a lot of other stuff with media, but just the force of one man to change history. Like if you're a real, you know, a structuralist and you believe like, you know, structures, are the things that like change history. It's not great man history. Like Napoleon isn't the guy who did that. It was other people, or Hitler wasn't the main person. It was about, you know, German nationalism. You have a really hard time explaining why, you know, explaining Tackwood, because he really is, you know, the key mover in a lot of these events, which, you know, says something. If that means the U.S. intelligence is a key mover in a lot of the events that were happening, which just, you know, I think makes us question, you know, where we move, and also just not glorifying everything the Panthers did or these groups did, knowing that they were infiltrated. We have to look at them and know them as like groups that are infiltrated and that made good decisions, but obviously made bad decisions on their own behalf, but also with the encouragement of the government, who, you know, sometimes knew that certain things would get them in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I was reading in the book too, like Hoover was bragging that he had the files of 200,000 radicals left of center. And that was back then. And I was thinking like all of the ways that we can get information now, like I can't even imagine the level of like surveillance. Like Jen and I were all also talking a couple of days ago about just how like things like AI and you know, smartphones totally changed the landscape of what's possible to be like pried out. It's scary, bro.
I think that's also another part is like this whole influencer economy too, which I think is pretty interesting, where you can buy followers and stuff like that. And that's also just another thing to be interested in is like, there's also, you know, that I saw recently that the White House is doing a event for TikTokers to explain their, you know, their position on the war in Ukraine.
Are you serious?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think it was Washington Post yesterday or 2 days ago. But they kind of want understanding of these things to be broadcast to younger people, which are, you know, the White House talking points on things like that. So I think we should be like, you know, the things that would fit in an FBI file back in the day, because I've seen some of them. It's like train tickets. It's like maybe they had your phone tapped, but it was only one line that they had tapped. Now it's like, imagine you have your smartphone. Oh, they know things about you don't know. Oh, he goes, he likes, you know, he gets craving for bagels at 9:30 a.m. things on your phone that you can imagine, you know, if there's this, you know, imaginary FBI file, these are the things that are like, it's, you know, to the tune of hundreds of times more information that you could have gotten when it would have just been train tickets, interviews with your friends. Like, you know, we're kind of bearing it all just in the ways that we have our phones that are, you know, right next to us. So I think that, yeah, that's the, you know, so, you know, if we're to imagine like our imaginary FBI file, it's can be much more full now than it would have been then. But, you know, even then they're like hundreds of pages long for people who are just, you know, academics and people who don't even go to protests and they're being, you know, FBI files, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages long. So yeah, just to thinking about what the breadth is and how you can store these things and how you can search these things. It's, you know, it's a pretty interesting thing to think about, but it's, you know, it's since we're so behind, and because, you know, military technology is also, you know, tends to be 10, 20 years ahead of what consumer technology is. You know, it's something we really can only imagine about at the end of the day.
Wow. That's a great point too. I was curious to ask you too, like, it seems like the CIA and all of the various police departments across the US were working in concert like perfectly back then. And I don't know, it's not that I don't think it's happening now in the same way, but it seemed like, right, a real network unified. And I'm curious how much you know about how like the CIA, FBI and like all the police departments kind of act in unison currently. We're not supposed to know about that at all, obviously, but
I just don't
know any leads.
I would say that the most like the realest thing I have, I mean, I think there's like real obvious stuff about like just surveillance of, you know, people involved in Black Lives Matter protests and the kind of the rebellions last year and stuff like that. Like, I think that's pretty obvious, and we've known that that's been going on for a while. Like, you know, the weird things going on in Ferguson with all the you know, the Black male leaders getting murdered within 3 years. I think that there's really weird things about that. And, you know, obviously we're going to know in a lot of years what those FBI, maybe not what those kind of FBI, CIA police files are going to look like of of those people. But I think the most obvious one, which people didn't care about, and people honestly, many people cheered on, was what we, I mean, I don't know if we're still doing, I assume we're still doing it, but is the surveillance of Muslims in America at mosques, using informants in that way. I think that's the best example. You know, like many, like, for example, Anwar al-Awlaki, someone who's connected to, you know, the alleged hijackers and bought through the tickets or whatever, is, you know, was a former CIA asset, or was a former US asset. And so I think it's pretty interesting to, and I think there's a whole kind of, I don't know if it's like a black hole. It's this, you know, information that we're probably not going to know for decades about, you know, what the CIA was doing, how they were surveilling Muslims. I know there's a really, really terrible stories, and they're only, you know, they're all on Google about, phone taps, you know, people being sent to prison, and also other stuff where it's like people who are, you know, mentally ill or might have, you know, other things going on, being entrapped into places where they're being given bombs by, you know, FBI, and then being told they're the, like, you know, with the kind of knowing their mental health issues, and then being charged with terrorism based on stuff like that. So I think that's one of those concerns. And because of, you know, the fervor after 9/11, a lot of that stuff was cheered on, just like the Patriot Act. And I think things that we should have been more suspicious of, but that, you know, those are always the time where those things kind of go through and are gonna happen. So I think that's probably the one in American memory where there's, you know, you can imagine there being local police who are reporting back to, you know, federal agencies and things like that, or making files about people who could be quote unquote suspicious, which I think we would know, like, the demographics of people they consider suspicious, which are going to be, you know, Black people and Middle Eastern people of, you know, based, and, you know, question is based on what? And so that to me is the one where we have like the documents for it. But I think it's pretty obvious for, like, there, especially in San Diego, I know there were a lot of arrests around the Black Lives Matter movement. A lot of people got their homes with warrants, like got raided, and I think or in late 2020, early 2021, and I think they're still facing cases around stuff like that. So I think that is kind of the what would be a little bit of the proof that there's some coordination of at least between the local police and the district attorneys in charging people for the protests. But, you know, probably that they're just keeping notes on, which we would expect, on people who they would think would be trouble. The question of who's taking those notes, I think, is another question. Of course, we just know that there's a lot of historical examples for this. We don't exactly have the documentation to prove a lot of this right now. But I think that's a good point, is like, we didn't have a lot of, and we still don't have a lot of documentation for, you know, the MLK stuff, the JFK stuff, even now, like, it's still trickling out. And the question is, you know, why is it not out yet 50 years later?
Man, wait, and you were talking about the hijackers earlier. That's for 9/11, I'm assuming. Wow. He was a CIA asset?
It's unclear who he was an asset for, but Anwar al-Awlaki was, and he was implicated in the Cole bombing. I can't remember what year but it's before 9/11, the USS Cole bombing. He was in, and this is something that came out recently, he was in a Yemeni prison for his alleged role in the Cole bombing, which was a USS Cole. It was a ship that was bombed, and I think a couple sailors died, and there's major damage to the ship. And that was one of the, there was that, and then the embassy bombing, and then 9/11, which were the major kind of Al-Qaeda turning against the United States. But the major thing to remember is that Al-Qaeda as a network was in support of, was the network that was funded by the United States to counter the Soviets in Afghanistan, right? So they get all, especially during the late 80s, but even into 1993, 1994, even, the U.S. has public support for Osama bin Laden, and then that switches over. So I think that's, you know, one of the other interesting things is kind of the use of right wing terror to achieve political aims outside the United States. Like if you look at something like Afghanistan and stuff like that. But yeah, in terms of Anwar al-Awlaki, he was an American, and he was, you know, famously killed by a drone by Obama, which brought up like a major philosophical debate. And I don't want to say where he was killed, since I don't exactly remember, but he was killed in the Middle East. And it brought up a philosophical debate about, you know, whether you can execute Americans without charging them with the crime. But yeah, he went from I did all of those things and then got out of the Yemeni prison at that with the help of the CIA director. And then, yeah, there's a lot of stuff about Anwar al-Awlaki. Both of his son and daughter actually have been killed since in separate incidents by the U.S. government. I think his son was killed in a bomb strike, and his daughter was shot. His young daughter was shot. So, that is Anwar al-Awlaki is kind of one person who is involved in a lot of this kind of FBI surveillance of Moss and stuff that was going on at the time. And I think, you know, if that's one of the things that's going to get looked at in America as, you know, one of the most kind of brutal and out in the open things that the government and the population kind of supported, I think, you know, in 10, 20 years.
Wow. That's mind blowing information. On a more hopeful tip, who are some of the organizers or some of the organizations that you really look up to, Panthers or otherwise?
I mean, obviously the Panthers, and I think there's, they're kind of the, you know, being from the Bay Area, they're by far the strongest model. I think the thing that makes something like the Students for Democratic Society, which is like Katz and Duggan, who wrote this book we're in, and something like the Panthers, is that like the Panthers had a real international vision and had like genuine international support. One of the coolest moments I had in college was we got to look at Huey Newton's diary from the time he went to Palestine. He had notes from like a meeting with Yasser Arafat. Someone had taught him how to write Huey Newton in Arabic on his diary. And it was, you know, it was like a really amazing touch to show that like a lot of those members, especially of like the, of that Black radical movement during that time, became internationalists very quickly. Malcolm X, you know, he spent the last 2 years of his life, about a year and 3-4 months he spent out of the country. I mean, a lot of that was because he was, you know, there are people trying to kill him in the country and he wanted to get out and other reasons. But other parts was that he was working with African leaders. He was meeting with African leaders. He was, going to the Muslim world and finding himself and trying to make the links between, Black people in America and, you know, the larger movement against imperialism that was going on at the time. So I think that's one of the reasons why I think the Panthers are so important, is because quite early on they realized that, you know, it's not only, you know, we can't protest our government because we don't want to get drafted. You know, that's the selfish reason. The real reason is that, you know, this is part of an imperialistic war and that we see ourselves as Vietnamese workers. So why would we fight Vietnamese workers and Vietnamese peasants? And so I think that kind of international look at things is very important, is one of the reasons why the Panthers is cool as a group. I mean, in terms of groups and recently, I'd say they have to be probably the first one, which is, I would say is a little unfortunate. I think the other one is the prisoners movement in California, which is, if people don't, it's something that people should look into, but it's led by the prison gangs. And if you look at what's been done in kind of the last 10 years in California, prison reforms, it started with a hunger strike, and it across multiple prisons, led by, you know, through the organization of the prison gangs. And what it came out to is there have been more reforms in the last 10 years than there were in the previous, you know, 40 years. And that's not because like Newsom has done anything, or because, you know, college educated people have decided that it's time to give people in prison more rights. No, California prisons have been the places that they have been for years, without resources and everything like that. And they're slowly changing in terms of people incarcerated are getting more power. But, you know, of course, one of the interesting things about the California prisons is they have like an informant system where you can get punished for things an informant says, and the informant does not have to reveal themselves. So there's like you can go to your board of parole, you can get not written up at all. But if an informant says that you stole something, hit him, did something like that, then you might get denied solely based on that. And so there's no way to check it. There's nothing like that. So you can kind of see how that same system that, you know, that was trying to kill George Jackson for years and years, which he was, you know, there were allegations that prison guards were bribing people to bribe the neo-Nazis to kill George Jackson. They wouldn't do it. These things have been going on for a while.
So when I started to learn more about Black radical history, especially in the 60s and 70s, I started to see how conservative and like messed up California governance usually is. And, you know, what it reminded me of is how the North, like in terms of like the North, the Midwest, New York, everything, they're always like, oh, you know, we're not racist because we're not the South. Like, you know, there wasn't slavery here. We were on one side of the war, the one that won, protected the Union, emancipated, freed the slaves. And yet, you know, being a Midwesterner, us living in Ohio and Chicago and elsewhere, like it was very clear that the North is also racist. And I just like, I thought of that being funny for California too, because, you know, I think they very much have this image of Cali being like really progressive and like, you know, not racist. And yet when you're actually inside of it, you're like, oh snap, this is just a different kind of the same story and the same thing. So like, what in your opinion, like, why is that? Like, how does that happen? Like, what is it like being, you know, on the ground there in California, and kind of having to like negotiate, you know, how California is usually seen and then how it actually is for the day to day as a person of color?
No, I mean, that's always the question. Yeah, especially when people are like, ah, oh, Cali, it's no. You don't understand, like, the criminal justice system here is notoriously bad. And just for like, as an example of kind of from the time that we were talking about, like, where does gun control in California come from? Everybody knows California is this liberal state that hates guns. Well, where does that come from? Because they were quite all right with, you know, white folks owning guns. It comes when Black Panthers are going around and are saying, no, we're going to stand 25. We're going to follow the penal code. We're going to stand as many feet away as we need to. And we're going to open carry assault rifles, whatever we need to make sure that you're not brutalizing, you know, that the police weren't brutalizing people when they pulled people over, when they stopped them on the streets without a warrant, which of course is illegal, but is not, it was still happening. When all these things were happening, Governor Reagan, who we know where he went next, put in gun control, and there was unanimous support from the Democrats as well. So it's pretty interesting to see, like, if there's some unity in California, it's against the interest, as you said, of kind of black and brown people. But, you know, going to today, there's pretty interesting parts about, like, how, there was just a recall, right? And Newsom vetoed a lot of bills, or criminal justice bills that, people thought that he would obviously support, or a lot of criminal justice bills that we thought were going to have easy support from the Democrats didn't pass. And it's pretty interesting, like, knowing about how things work in the California legislature. Like, you know, one pretty funny story I've heard from, you know, Democrats who are there, or people who know about what's happening, is that they're like, yeah, the Republicans just laugh at us. Because like there is like the kind of the, what maybe call it the left wing of the Democratic Party, who wants this criminal justice reform. And then there's the moderate wing, who everyone just kind of knows will side with Republicans on most things, but on issues of criminal justice, on issues of the budget, on issues of climate, on issues of, you know, of public health and stuff like this, they're going to side with the Republicans. So it's pretty interesting how like the levers of power are also, like, on Fox News every night you turn on, you see LA like controlled by Newsom, and Newsom's like this really progressive guy, when in reality there's this balance of power between the conservatives and their kind of third of the state, the moderate Democrats, and they're maybe 40-50% of the state in terms of legislature. And then there's the progressives, which make up the 20%, which play this really difficult game between trying to call out their colleagues who won't go for any of this stuff, and, you know, still be in the party. And it's a really interesting tension that exists in California politics. And that's just on criminal justice. But you can say the ways, like, Newsom took a big swing right before the recall. That all of the bills that are coming through the legislature this year from the governor's desk and the prerogatives, even from Democrats, are about retail theft, which is, you know, something that if you kind of look at the numbers on, is something that's, you know, been overblown by media and stuff like that. So I think that's one of the things that's important to note about California politics, is how there's the split between the Democrats is often more important than whatever split is perceived between the moderate Democrats and the Republicans. And then that's where the real kind of politics is made. But, you know, there is even kind of unwillingness on the progressive side to even show which one of the moderate Democrats are, you know, not really moving stuff forward. So it's hard to see how things, you know, move in a better way unless more people who are progressive get elected there. But also we have to realize, you know, a lot of these places are reflections of the people who live there. And that's something we have to deal with at the end of the day. If, you know, people think these things, even though, you know, we might know that, you know, the criminal justice system is bad, like that, you know, we start to see where these electoral politics are really difficult and become difficult to move things. Because it's not like all of these issues now, you know, George Jackson was fighting for all the same prison issues that the people inside now are fighting for. So from that level, it's, you know, it is something that's generational, but there is something wrong with California that's making it that way from the time of George Jackson's killed to now when people are still incarcerated. And there's, you know, many times more people incarcerated now than even at that time. Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, to answer my own question about organizers and organizations, I would say Silicon Valley Debug is one of the like great, great groups, great models that's been replicated, you know, across the country. So, you know, could you tell us a little bit more about like the work that you all are doing to, you know, help criminal justice in your state?
Yeah. Yeah. I could talk about it. But yeah, it's Silicon Valley Debug. It's based out of San Jose, but I think the real stuff that comes out of it that's important is the participatory defense model, which came out of experiences that were had in San Jose by families, you know, police violence, police killing people, and even people who are having cases. And what they would do is they'd fill the courtrooms on sentencing day or on all the court days. But it was really the attorney in there, the defense attorney and the prosecutor in there going at it, right? There was no involvement by the family in trying to, you know, put a thumb on the scales of justice finally for a person who was accused instead of, you know, for the state in trying to put this person under the ground. So what that evolved from is these meetings with families in person over a table that were once a week to try to work on cases. And through that came this model, which and kind of the basis of the model is that you meet weekly. Is that, you know, families will come if you either come with your own case that you're facing or someone else's case. And well, it's pretty simple is we just look at, you know, what are some of the updates that we have? And then what are some of the things that we can do as, you know, people, not attorneys, to affect the criminal justice process. So oftentimes that involves like writing letters of support. Maybe you need some mental health or treatment for substance abuse. So we can get a letter of acceptance from, you know, one of the treatment centers. We can help do research on a motion proving that, you know, you're only charged on this crime. For example, prostitution. That's something that's only charged against Black men. Like 95% is charged against Black men. So we can do a motion where we see that, you know, this is something that's being racially charged, that there's no one else being charged for this besides Black people. And so there's like many other things that we can do, but the idea is that we use kind of what community has to offer, and like the knowledge that community has. So if there's a cop who's testifying and we know he's beating heads in, then we'll have people, you know, we'll make a video and we'll talk about, you know, why people's experience with that cop and why, you know, this testimony, and just say, well, you can take this testimony for what it is, but we also know that this is what he's doing in the community. So it's a way to try to get community knowledge into the courtroom. And that's done kind of through these weekly meetings. So it started from just Santa Clara County and it's done by counties. And now it's in like 10 plus counties in California out of the 50. And then it's in nationally, there's like 40 different counties with hubs in them. And they each kind of do their own thing. Some of them like, have like local systems where the sheriff will transfer people to ICE, right? So they have to focus more on immigration so that they can keep people and that the people don't get, sent out. So, you know, because, you know, some counties in California will deport people. Some sheriffs will choose to deport people based on like crimes that they did, you know, 20 years ago or things like that. So, that's kind of the basic parts of participatory defense. And then there's some like, you know, bill work that Debug will do. One that was really cool was this game enhancement bill, which came out last year, which was a bill that started in 1988, purportedly to address violence on the streets. But what it ended up doing is, you know, locking people up for, you know, people who I know will serve, you know, 20 years, and now they're only on this enhancement time. So if you did a robbery as a white person, you know, you do your 10 to 15 years and you get out. But as a brown or black person between 1988 or now, you know, there's a chance that if you did it with other people, that you'd be charged with a gang enhancement. And, you know, the conviction rate for gang enhancements are very high because, you know, if a jury who are, you know, mostly predominantly white, see a person, they're like, then the, you know, the prosecutor says, oh, this is a gang member, then it's not a hard step for, you know, someone who is, who believes all the things that people say about gang members to think that this person would shoot or would sell drugs because of all of these kind of media things about that. So that's one of the bills that we were able to increase the standard on that and to make it much, much harder for prosecutors to place gang enhancements on people because, you know, I think about 97% are on people of color. So, you know, that you would think, oh, well, maybe they'll get neo-Nazi gangs. Well, you know, I've looked at some of the data in the county that I'm in, and two of the three white people are connected to Latino gangs. And only one of them I can find is actually white with no connection to any people of color. So there's only, you know, one out of 250 who is actually, you know, a white person, maybe in a white gang. I still, you know, still can't find it, but that looking at these like types and knowing that, you know, public defenders are also, you know, they have, I don't even know how many cases, sometimes 30, 40, 50, and that, you know, their whole job is clearing cases. And, you know, that's, you know, sometimes not the best thing. And oftentimes isn't the best thing for people who are facing charges and are facing 10 years of prison time, you know, who never get to see the police report. So that's another one of our, what we try to do is slow down the process so people don't get caught in this, just, you know, this automatic crusher of, you know, the criminal justice system, and make sure that we slow the process down. And, you know, sometimes it's the choice between, you know, the best thing you can get is 5 years, and that's, you know, that's the best outcome for some people. So always know, like, knowing that there are times where, you know, we're not, you know, people are going to have to go to prison sometimes based on how the laws are written in the state. But that we can do like as much as we can and feel good sleeping at night, that we know we did as much as we can. And I think that's the nice part, is it gives people who want to do that extra involvement to try to affect things, to be able to affect things. But, you know, what you'll see is that a lot of people, you know, aren't at that point yet in their life where they can do that for themselves. So sometimes they'll have family, but, you know, sometimes it is a lot of work to try to, you know, help fight your own case. So that's some of the stuff we do. And it's like kind of at the individual casework stuff all the way to the legislation.
So bro, are you a lawyer? Like, what's up?
luckily not. Nah, we, and that's the whole thing, is like we don't like give legal advice or anything like that. And
really, okay,
we always family follow what the families want and like connect, and like a lot of the help is like connecting them to their lawyer. But like the whole point is we want you to know all your options, so you research that law. Like the lawyer could tell you that this law gives you 5 years, but you should know what that law says to see if, you know, if you didn't do, if it's going to take XYZ to convict you and you didn't do XYZ, then you shouldn't be, you know, you shouldn't take that plea deal. So really having people understand, you know, what's that penal code 755 or all of these different things that people will usually trust lawyers on. We want people to, you know for themselves that this plea deal is the best for you, that if you go to trial, yeah, it would be bad. And that, yeah, maybe this plea deal is the best. But a lot of times people will just take the plea deal because that's what our justice system makes them do, right? 99 or 98% of cases are finished in a plea deal instead of a trial. So while we think that the criminal justice system is like To Kill a Mockingbird or something like that, it really is things that are settled, right? Just in court, and people are usually unhappy with the plea deal, but forced between, you know, a year if they take the deal versus, you know, maybe 10 if they go to trial and try to fight it. And so there's, you know, that's the kind of the plea deal system is one of the things that's that is really tough. It's one of the really tough things about the criminal justice system. And you can imagine being fixed if, you know, we weren't charging so many people, right? We could actually give people court time that they need, but instead we got to hustle everything along because there's so much court backlog because police are out there, you know, getting busy giving people cases.
Yeah. So, I mean, you said luckily you're not a lawyer. I mean, why is it so important that
you like, you know, aren't, or like, you know, why is it so important that you know the things you know, like help in the way you do and like do it just as Zach or as Debug, right? Like, why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that go in with lawyering that I'm pretty happy I don't have to do. Like, there's a lot of paperwork and stuff like that. And so in the sense is, you know, we still, the good things that lawyers get to do are, you know, they get to help people in these situations, which is like the main reason that I'm doing it. But I also realized like through doing the work, I think like, you know, I probably will go to law school, you know, eventually. That's, you know, probably where this is going. But, you know, I think it's, you know, working here has really shown that like, there's a lot, you know, people can do from, you know, just filing public records requests to their local police officers, filing public records requests to their prison to see, you know, what's the racial breakdown of people charged with this type of thing, and saying like, you know, maybe we can use that in a motion. And so like a lot of my job is like knowing about things that are happening, about new bills and things like that, and then making sure that an attorney who might do cases all day, they might not have time to, you know, read this email, a bunch of emails that just came in about this new law, but this could, you know, this new law could be the difference between their client getting out now. And so like our knowledge of that and just keeping up to date on those type of things are the, you know, the things that could make the difference. And knowing that like an attorney, when they go into an individual case, what they're thinking isn't like, how can I give this person, like, how can this person charged with murder get 0 days? They're thinking like, what's the best outcome that I can get? But like, since we work with families are always saying, no, we need to get him out. Right. So there's like an extra kind of like pep in the step of the families and like the organizers. We just follow along. Right. In terms of if families want to do something, then we'll just support in it. But, you know, there's an extra kind of pep in their step and they're willing to do anything. You know, they're willing to call people. They're willing to do things that attorneys just aren't willing to do. So letting attorneys know that there's, you know, family members can be helpful, and they're willing to call every single treatment center in the county to try to get an acceptance letter. Like it is a help for attorneys. And so in that sense, it's really nice because, you know, you can see yourself like improving what's happening in the courtrooms, and, you know, motions are being improved because families have input on what's happening in the motions and things like that. And so like making those connections is, I guess I'm being selfish, but, you know, feels good as a thing. And I know, yeah, there are things like in terms of arguing where I'll be in court where I'm like, I should argue that way, or, you know, I shouldn't have mentioned that, or, you know, things like that where I'm in the courts a lot. So I'll see things like that, but, you know, there's good things about attorneys, you know, salary and things like that, but I definitely don't envy the, you know, the paperwork and the, a lot of the paper pushing and stuff that they have to do, which is one of the reasons why I said it's much nicer just to be able to, you know, talk to directly impacted people and just, you know, brainstorm and do things like that, and not having to deal with judges all day, not having to deal with DAs all day. Like I'm pretty lucky that I don't have to do that part of the work.
No, by the time that you know, you go through law school, if you want to, they'll have AI that will do all the paperwork stuff. No, seriously, they have like an AI bot that's like doing it now, or learning how to, but you'll probably still want to, you know, go over all the things that it misses. But what was I going to say? Oh, my favorite fact, probably my favorite fact of anything, like sports, world, anything related, is from Debug. And I remember when I watched Raj's TED Talk however many years ago, he has this thing tracked called Years Saved, where literally just people helping people, not for money, like they're not lawyers, again, they're just like advocating for their family, for their friends, for their community. And they've saved like thousands of years of people's lives doing this. I don't know what the number is at now, but I remember it was an insane number of years when I first heard about it. But, you know,
real quick, Miles, can you elaborate more on the TED Talk you're referring to?
Yeah. So Raj Jayadev is one of the leaders of Debug, the founder. But it's just about, you know, the participatory defense model and like how he was, you know, executing it and replicating it across the U.S. as Zach was saying. And then at the end of the talk, he gives this stat of like the amount of years saved from doing this model. It's like in the thousands, only in the, you know, very nascent period that it started. And what was I going to say? I forgot. But yeah, Zach, do you know what the number is at now? Or
I mean, it's actually funny you ask. I think where the number is going to come out maybe this next week. We haven't done it because you know, with COVID and everything, like a lot of trials and sentencings and things have been pushed back. But I think we're going to have the number this week. Last number I saw was 10,000 years of time saved, meaning that that people were going to serve this time. And that was time that because of community involvement, because of family writing letters or, you know, family testifying in court, whatever it was, there was time saved. Like, you know, I've been part of one, and it's partly a testament, of course, to what the family's doing, but also just the horrendous, you know, DA practices. Like if you had intended to give this person, you know, 2 years, there was no reason really to say at the arraignment that this, you know, that this 18-year-old boy was going to get a life sentence, you know, and to have his mom hear that the first time that she went to court, you know, and to think that for 3 months that her son's getting a life sentence. So that it's really those two things. One is you see family involvement, but you also see, you know, this number is also evidence of overcharging and the fact that, you know, these people never should have been charged for all of these years. But, you know, one case that I can think of that, you know, I know about is, you know, guys charged 115 years for something that, you know, would be 5 to 10 if without kind of his conviction history and, you know, things he went through. It's, you know, it's 100 years time saved. There are other cases where it's, you know, juveniles and it's only 6 months, but, you know, with the juvenile, that's the difference between, you know, getting kicked out of school and not getting kicked out of school if you have to serve time in juvenile hall and stuff like that. So, I mean, there's a lot of stories about it, but the kind of saying 10,000 years is just like, it just makes your mind hurt to think about that. But keep in mind, you know, there are people who didn't get any time in jail and they're only facing 30 days. And that was a huge win for them, is that they didn't have to serve any time in jail. Or other people who, if they serve time in jail, they'll lose custody of their kids and things like this. So, of course, incarceration, you know, it's one of the worst things that, you know, that can happen to someone, especially, you know, over the time period that we see it happen. But it is really great, you know, to see people who came in, you know, facing 30, never step foot in a jail again after they pay bail. Like that just blows your mind to think that, you know, those things are happening. And then, you know, you always think about just that other person, or if they, you know, if you wouldn't have been in court that day. And there's so many cases like that where the difference between us meeting someone is us being in court and them asking a question or them looking confused. And I'm like, oh, do you need something? They're like, yeah, actually this is going on and this is how you can help. So it is kind of this feeling that if only we had this for every kind of case, then we could really, one, start doing something and two, actually have the power to change things about this system. But, you know, there are things, and I'll do it to put on a light note because I know all of this stuff is, but there are, you know, there are things that are looking up, I think, for in really slow ways about California criminal justice, just in terms of resentencing options of people who've been serving, like these gang enhancements have been serving these long terms, being able to come home. Sometimes, you know, under certain circumstances, and there's a lot of pushing to do, but, you know, there are people who coming home 20 years earlier than they thought, or people who thought they were going to, you know, die inside it, who are coming home in smaller numbers through these resentencing laws and through things like that. But, you know, it still is really tough. You know, I think the border parole, I think under 20% of hearings are granted. I mean, that's imagine, you know, you wait 10 years for a parole hearing and then you get denied, or and you don't have one for another 10 years or something like that. So I think there, you know, what we always have our eye on is trying to get people home try to keep people home if they haven't been incarcerated yet. But I think there are things to look at and see, you know, this is promising, or, you know, maybe, you know, we can get people home this way, or you can see kind of how a lot of the, especially enhancements that gave a lot of time are kind of crumbling and, you know, will continue to crumble as, like, you know, we think that there's more and more people power, as, you know, more and more people get released and kind of tell their experiences about these things, which is always how these things are going to get changed. It's never going to be the kind of the college educated person telling you about a prison cell, because they probably can't tell you about the prison cell. And that's kind of like, if I'm to kind of distill it, is like one of the things that we try to focus on is just always knowing that kind of these stories are going to be the uplift of our communities and the downfall of kind of all of the things that are harming them.
No, Zach, I got to ask, just friend to friend, our brother to brother, man, to, like, how do you consume information? Like, how do you read? Because I know that you just like, you know, obviously read a lot of books, you know, you're online, you're watching speeches, videos, like you have such a way of processing information. It's very beautiful to see in motion. I'm just curious, like, even I think your act of speaking the information and teaching it to others helps in that processing, you know? I'm very curious about how you just learned so much.
One thing is that I just can't read it all. Like, that's one thing with me is that I've always been like someone to listen to stuff like radio shows, things like that. So I mean, with a lot of this kind of California stuff, right, the people I mentioned who wrote the book, Donald Freed, Mae Brussel, and even the press conference with Lewis Tackett, it's on KPFK. Like, there are decades and decades of archives of, you know, information specifically on like California radical politics that was done through, you know, public radio, and by other researchers. So that's one of them, is that I'm always listening. Like, there's a couple podcasts that I like listening to about stuff like this. And then, I don't know, I usually just buy books that are in the footnotes of books that I'm reading. And if you're trying to go down a rabbit hole, that's probably the best way, is just to, read the things that, you know, people you're interested are reading. So, you know, like, I never read, for example, Lenin 4 years in college or anything like that. But, you know, after Kwame Ture said, I read Lenin, Malcolm said, well, I read Lenin. All of these people said, I read Lenin. Well, then I guess, you know, I'll read Lenin. And so I think that's, you know, that's kind of what my process is it's not as intentional, but it just goes from thing, you know, from topic to topic. And it's also just like, a lot of this is, as you can see, like, we went back and forth from a conversation about prisons in 1960 to prisons today, is because, you know, a lot of these things are still, like, the dynamics are still there. The informant dynamics are still there, just because we don't know about them and we can't talk about them like as sure. And because, you know, maybe we don't have someone like Tackwood who came out today. And that's like really the issue, is that if that one person came out, then we would know a lot more about what's happening today. But yeah, another thing is just, and it sounds dumb, you know, Twitter. But I've always kind of just like going down like rabbit holes and reading about articles and stuff like that. But I think the thing that's been motivating recently is, I think there were a lot of like, I followed like a lot of news growing up, and I was really attached to like just normal news. So now going from reading about those things at the time to looking at them now and like studying them deeper, and is really the thing that I think is interesting. It's like going over all this kind of new knowledge and being like, well, that changed, you know, completely updates the way, like with Tackwood, now we have to think of the Panthers differently because of the involvement of Tackwood and obviously other informants that were doing, you know, hopefully not as damaging things as Tackwood was, but probably were doing damaging or more damaging things than Tackwood. And I think that's one of the things I keep in mind. But I think, yeah, Twitter is pretty interesting. And there's like, I get a lot of my reading from like, you know, certain people who are interested in you know, Black Panther politics and things like that. So it really is following the footnotes is the way I've seen. But also just like, just knowing that nobody can, like, at least for me, like, I can read 2 hours for fun a day, and that's probably about it. Like, I'm done at that point. So, but, you know, I'm quite happy just going around listening to podcasts while I'm walking around doing errands. So that's the way I do it. And it feels, you know, feels kind of fun. And so, yeah, that's one of the things too, is like, it's something that is kind of, you know, fun for me to read and, to listen to this stuff and to, you know, find out that you were wrong about the way that you understood a lot of these things, that occurred in history the first time. I think that's really like the goose chase is like trying to get some kind of like real understanding for the world, or, you know, trying to find it through learning about these things. And I, even though it's, you know, Tackwood, it you know, it does feel relevant today, just all of the things that 100%. He talks about, the, you know, the level of sophistication of like policing and just like, just a lot of the themes of, you know, it just feels like we're in the same age again with Tackwood, and that we might need another Tackwood to break through a lot of the stuff that we're seeing. But I think Twitter is a major one now. And then there's a lot of different independent researchers who do these type of things and are kind of like do this for their side hobby, which I'm grateful for. And I kind of, we all talk to each other. So it's kind of a fun thing to be involved in.
Wow. That's so amazing, man. No, you're definitely right about reading. Like, you can only really max out like 2 hours of good focus of like reading. It's pretty difficult now, you just will get distracted really fast, and having the listening component is crucial. And I think just it's so important for, it's like another layer of information, like hearing, like everyone listening to this podcast, you have a much better, chance of getting your hands on the audio, which is on YouTube, that Zach sent me the link for prior to the show. But it's just so interesting hearing Tackwood speak with the cops and with the interviewers, like, right, you just get another layer of depth to it that you don't even get in the book, mm-hmm. Even his personality, right? So, but on the listening cue too, more of a fun question, who are some of the Bay Area rap artists, West Coast, music that you can put us onto now, bro? You really were the guy that put me onto all of it. So who are you bumping now?
Oh my gosh, right now I'll start with where do I want to start? No, I can start with probably my two favorites. One of them is Briss out of South Sacramento. Rest in peace to Briss. And he was an artist out of South Sacramento. I would say very, very like grimy beats, but they have like a certain bop that like has, I think some real it's a smooth bop, and it's real listenable, and it's if you know Bay Area rap, it's like a lot of like it's very punny, and it's very rhymy, and
dancing on rap. Tricky dead moves, bro.
Yeah, it's very, but yeah, that's, and so that I would say Briss is one. He's probably, to me, is like the best in that new bop. And then also the other one is obviously Draco the Ruler, which is the same kind of bop, but just totally different flow, totally different lyrics, like just in terms of like, I think people always say like, Shakespeare per 1,000 words, he had the most like new words. If you listen to Draco, there's no, there's no one who has more kind of crazy wordplay. Just like the way that you can kind of imply things about criminal activity you're doing without actually saying it, and just the way he plays with kind of like the alleged and the implying things rather than saying them, it's really kind of slippery and funny. And there's always, I think the best thing with Draco is he's always kind of taunting the DA, and he's always taunting the catch him.
Like,
he's
like, I'm about to say, are rappers just informants, y'all, or are they just like the legacy?
Draco.
No, I mean, the whole thing with Draco is like the interesting thing is like his music has like battles with the DA. He's like, right. And his brother too, like, if they're so tough, why the only one they indicted was us? Like, stuff like that, they kind of brag about how they're the ones that are targeted by the police, but also say like, I'm trying to think of the other line, the DA wants to find me after trial because I beat him. All 12 jurors not guilty, beat it. And like, he's telling the DA to beat it. Because if you know about Draco, he beat murder charges twice. By Los Angeles County District Attorney, which is one of the most well-funded district attorneys in the nation. So I think that he's another one because he's pretty silly and stuff like that. But during those last 2 years of his life, he hit like a different kind of like West Coast bop that's getting pretty popular now. In terms of other artists, there's some other good ones. Stunna June, he's Tongan. Some of the other ones that people like are EBK J-Bo. I think he's pretty cool. there's a lot of different things going on in California rap right now. But it's especially like with California, the stuff that, you know, and I'll sound dumb in a while, but the stuff that always is going to be the staple is the street rap. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, people will say like, I'm not going to sign a California artist if you're not one, because no one listens to California street rap besides California people, and nobody from California wants to listen to a California pop artist. So these are kind of the things that, you know, California rap and hip hop and R&B face in terms of getting bigger. And there are people like Mozzie who are pretty big, but yeah, I think people always say that like the Bay Area sound is much more prominent than any Bay Area artists. And I think that's, you know, that's pretty true. Just stuff that we're hearing.
Wow. The Bay Area sounds is more prominent than any Bay Area artist. No, yeah, that is facts. No, I mean, the thing I've appreciated most about the Bay Area rap is the real love of like wordplay and like real lyricism that I don't think you see in other regional scenes now. Like here in New York City, it's drill. You know, Atlanta is the kind of codeine, just you don't know what they're saying. And then Bay Area, though, it's still audible, and you know, you're hearing their words, and like their flow has a really interesting pace.
No, I mean, it's one of those things that I think people don't know the flows too well, and it is weird hearing it. But you know, I think the one thing for me is that people also think Bay Area, you know, they think Bay Area hyphy stuff, and it's like,
right,
that's not where we're like. People listen to that, but like people who are serious about who, like, of course, people love, we love E-40, you love Too Short and stuff like that. But like, that's 90s music. Like people, right. You know, it's like, if I go to New York and I start rapping like 90s Nas and saying like, yeah, this is the stuff we listen to. Like that's another thing that's important, is that just because what people know the Bay Area as, and what kind of like a, I don't know, a very, superficial quote Bay Area listener, your rap listener, is, you know, they're just gonna say I know Mac Dre and stuff like that. But you know, there has been advancement in certain things, and I think that like you know, understanding like the kind of Bay Area street rap is really interesting, just the sounds. And you know, there's a difference in sound between Southern Sacramento and Northern Sacramento. It's totally different. You know, they kind of rap the same, but you can hear it on the beats. The producers are different, and that's one of the interesting things as well, is that there's a lot of variation across the Bay Area, and people rap different based on cities and stuff like that. So there's a lot of room for being a rap nerd in the Bay Area. So I like doing it, and I think there's also, you know, there's good crosses with just looking at criminal justice and the targeting of people, like, you know, targeting of these rap artists by police, because, you know, they're really the most successful people in their city, of course, or in their, from, you know, from their neighborhood. But you know, other people, you know, successful people from other neighborhoods are you know, protected by police. You know, these people are targeted, and I think it's a really good study in the criminal justice system, and also just blanket kind of racism and how you know, especially Black artists kind of always, it is always looked at with suspicion, you know, no matter who it is.
Man, Zach, you really came on this show and just dropped some crazy stories, knowledge bombs, truth, everything, bro. Like this was another level, bro. Seriously, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. Just was a lot of fun.
I have fun too. I'm glad you could have me on and listen to some of the crazy stuff I have to say. But yeah, if people can find it, I know there's like kind of a link online that I know Miles and I read it on, where you just have to kind of sign in. But yeah, good luck finding the Tackwood book, and I hope that I'm not crowding my own market of trying to find a paperback copy by doing this. But no, it was great. It was great talking to y'all. And you know, I would encourage people also to, you know, look through the footnotes on this book, because it really is pretty interesting. And also just Googling any of the events that we mentioned, any of those stories, because they're all like I said, you know, if you look at a timeline of the 60s and 70s, we talked about, like, you know, in Black radical politics. We talked about a third of the events. So I think that people would be really interested in this history and like the conventional narrative versus, you know, stuff that, you know, that, you know, Huey Newton, Geronimo Pratt used to say, but also, you know, people like Tackwood, who now suddenly came in and now suddenly we believe Tackwood. So I think that's maybe is the final thing I would be pretty interesting is that, you know, Huey Newton was saying this all along. He was saying this from the beginning. Even Eldridge Cleaver was saying this from the beginning. People were saying this from the beginning, especially Geronimo Pratt. And he was naming names and stuff like that of people who Tackwood would say, yeah, later that person was an informant. And Geronimo Pratt, out of almost anybody in the Panthers, was the one who, you know, really had a nose for these things. But I think that's pretty interesting, you know, in retrospect, how these people said they were being surveilled. But it took the person who was surveilling them to come out and say that before we even kind of take them seriously. So I think that's one thing I still can't get my mind around, and maybe people at home can figure out.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Real Ballers Read podcast. As Zach was saying, you can find the Glasshouse tapes online at archive.org, or you can try and find one of the rare paperback copies. Zach was talking about earlier how Lewis Tackwood and an LAPD officer were talking about dynamite, and so we decided to add that phone call to the end of this episode. Check it out.
A 4-year-old tape-recorded phone conversation between one-time informant Lewis Tackwood and a Los Angeles police officer may be introduced at the San Quentin 6 trial. The phone conversation was recorded in Los Angeles in 1971 by members of the Citizens Research and Investigation Committee, the group Tackwood contacted when he decided to stop working for the L.A. Police Department. The conversation was first aired by KPFK Radio in Los Angeles and has been reprinted in a book about Tackwood called The Glass House Tapes. Excuse me. Although the L.A. police say they had very little to do with Tackwood, Tackwood himself claims that he was a paid police informant for over 10 years and was involved in espionage against the Black Panther Party in California. The following phone conversation is between Tackwood and Sergeant Lawrence Brown of the Los Angeles Police Special Investigation Section. It's a surprisingly frank conversation in which Tackwood and Sergeant Brown discuss a criminal conspiracy officer named Dan Mahoney, the purchasing of dynamite, killing someone named James, presumably James Carr, an ex-convict and close friend of George Jackson, who was murdered in San Jose several months after this conversation was recorded. The tape also discusses Tackwood's financial problems in dealing with CI&I, that's the State Criminal Identification and Investigation Department. What is most revealing is Tackwood's instant rapport with Sergeant Brown. Tackwood phones up, tells Brown, "I hope the heat kills you," and Brown immediately replies, "Hey, what's happening?" Here then is that phone conversation.
Good afternoon, Special Investigation Section Sergeant Brown. May I help you?
Yeah, I hope the heat kill you.
Hey, what's happening?
What are you, buddy?
What's happening?
Oh, nothing much. I just got my time. I ain't been able to get a hold of nobody. I mean, I'll tell you every now and then. What you been doing?
Well, I've just been sitting here perspiring and sweating.
Oh, yeah?
Waiting to go on my vacation.
When your vacation starts?
I'm starting Friday.
Good Lord.
That's why I'm not getting involved in anything.
Look out. Hey, you know, I talked to Mahoney yesterday.
Yeah, he mentioned this morning, just in passing, that you'd called.
Yeah, he told me what Austin says.
Who?
You remember where I went and bought the dynamite?
Oh, yeah.
And
what did he say?
That AET told him, he said, "Hey, man, you got a man in the force named Tackwood working for you."
Is that right?
Yeah, that sure did kind of hurt me. He should have busted him when I got the dynamite.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to tell you, Wendy went up to see James. And,
oh, yeah?
Yeah. You know something, though, man? They should have killed him, though.
James?
Yeah.
Well, that's the only way they're
going to
stop him.
They should have killed him when they had a chance to in Los Angeles. I don't know what they were bullshitting around about, because yeah. I'm going to tell you, he's dangerous, man. That man's a madman. But look here. What I wanted to ask you, old good buddy, is, when you going to be, you going to leave Friday?
Actually, I start Friday. I won't even be here. I'll be here about half day Thursday, and that's the end of it.
Oh, yeah? I got it before Thursday to see you, then,
Yeah. What's up?
I just want to tell you before you go on vacation, I want to see you. I got an old fit for that 25-year-old Scotch I was going to give you.
Oh.
Ooh. Yeah, I had a case of it. Ambassador Royal, I'll bring you old 25-year-old fit.
Where'd you get it, man?
Man, you know me. I know everybody in town. I know everybody in town. When you give me another case to work on?